Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the Phoenix Suns are facing a $60 million complaint from a former employee and how a Valley pastor is trying to combat the influence of Christian nationalism. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
When you get a chance for 56 days to change things, keep your foot on the gas, stay off the damn brake. Don't sleep for the next 56 days. Knock the doors and let's watch her do her work and let's go do ours.
But when a prize fighter loses a fight, you've seen a lot of fights, right? The first words out of that fighter's mouth is, I want a rematch. I want a rematch. And that's what she said. I want a rematch.
I think that the reason she didn't file a pre-primary challenge was Mr. Wei filed a false nomination paper saying he'd lived in the state for six continuous years prior to his running for office.
It seems like I have to get arrested to have him do anything.
What the data show is that even prepubescent boys have an advantage over girls. And in fact, any elementary school gym teacher will tell you that.
Do the same for highways and dams and railroads and see what happens. We implore you, please consider, if this is such a big deal, and if it is so important that we continue to have free, fair, and secure elections, fund them.
And with me to talk about former President Trump and Democratic VP nominee Tim Walz campaigning in Arizona, a court ruling in a legislative residency case, and more are Paul Bentz of High Ground. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
And Democratic strategist Tony Connie. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Tony, let me start with you just quickly on the debate. Obviously not an Arizona story, didn't happen here, but there were some issues that came up, specifically immigration came up a lot. What do you make of the debate?
I thought it was a great debate. I thought it was so good. You know, when a prize fighter loses, I don't know, whatever Trump was saying, is just like one of the weirdest things. I had two big reactions. One was a lot of people have continuously underestimated Vice President Harris, and she showed yet again that she is a gifted politician and a good communicator. And I think that that's the kind of thing that is going to help some people who maybe were trying to decide if they were for her or not lean towards her a little bit. I think Trump was unhinged on a lot of issues. You know, the big things that you're remembering from him are either embarrassing things about the, you know, lies about Haitian immigrants eating pets, or the fact that he just absolutely refused to say whether or not he would veto a federal abortion ban. I thought that it was a great debate. The thing that I'm thinking about a lot though since is the strong reaction by Trump and his allies to being unwilling to admit that he lost, or that even – I guess he wouldn't admit that he lost. That you know, it was so strong, it makes me really nervous about what's going to happen if he loses the election in November. I know that there's a lot of evidence that we should be nervous about that, but it's the same muscle. Like, they're just very used to finding – you know, throwing out as many different people that they can possibly blame. It was the moderators. It was, you know, the network. It was – you know, they're trying to say maybe she cheated, like all these kinds of things. And so it does have me like really, really nervous about the election.
Paul, do you think, obviously there are a lot of people who watched it. It was one of the most watched shows or, you know, things on TV in quite a while. Does this move the needle in any way in a place like Arizona, which is expected to be very close again?
I would expect that Harris gets a bump after the performance. She did very well. I think Trump looked not only unhinged, as Tony said, but unprepared,
yeah,
maybe a little tired. Unwilling to look at her while she was speaking, something that she did very well. I think his biggest miss is that when it was time to talk about immigration, the thing that he wanted to talk about and brought up in all three questions prior to the immigration question, when he got that chance, when it was his time to shine, he started talking about crowd sizes and eating pets. She got him so far off of his game that he couldn't even get back to the message that he's good at, and that's very effective in the state of Arizona. And I also think he missed a lot of opportunities. They pushed some questions on her that really were questions that he could have followed up on, but he's so wrapped up in talking about himself or wrapped up in talking about the issues that he cares about, he wouldn't press her on the questions asked, particularly among abortion and some other questions, that there were places he could go. But instead of talking about, you know, 7, 8, or 9, what, where are you at on this, and trying to get her to ground on that, instead he talked about killing infants. And even the moderator said that's not legal anywhere. And,
yeah.
And I did an unscientific focus group, talked to several older folks in the last couple of days. And the thing that I found from all of them is that the people who are tending towards Trump think that the media was out to get him. And that really indicates to me that they know he lost,
mm-hmm.
that the deck was stacked against him. They think it was not fair. I just don't think he performed very well. They asked her very difficult questions, which she skated around and didn't answer. But instead of him pushing her on those, he certainly came back to what he wanted to talk about, and his close was the biggest thing. He had a chance. When you close a debate, when you have the closing statement,
he was
last,
the last voice.
Yes. Mm-hmm. When you get to go last, it is your opportunity to make your case and ask for the vote. He did neither. He ended with, Joe Biden's the worst president ever. Harris is the worst vice president ever. They're the worst. They're the worst. I mean, that's such a terrible way to end a debate. I definitely think it should help her in the state of Arizona.
So let's compare what we heard at the debate to what we heard from the candidates and their surrogates in Arizona, both the day of and after, but also what we're going to be hearing from them coming up. We heard Tony yesterday, for example, from former President Trump in Tucson. He talked about the debate. He talked about a bunch of other stuff, as he tends to do. But he also talked about, for example, not taxing overtime wages. He talked about affordable housing. He seemed a little bit more, at least, on message. So I'm wondering, how much does it matter what we heard in the debate, and how much does it matter what we're going to hear between now and November?
I think they both matter. But one of the things about the debate is it's an opportunity to get something to sort of break into pop culture or break into sort of the regular minds of regular voters aren't paying a ton of attention. And so that's one of the challenges about a bad debate performance that goes as viral as some of the things that he said has. Some of these regular campaign stops are going to be consumed by people who are following the news. And so obviously that can have some impact, but it's just sort of two different audiences. I think but you know, in Arizona, as a Democrat, we won the last time by 10,000 votes. And so every single one of these events, every single one of these moments, if you're able to convince a couple of voters, it makes a big difference. This whole thing is going to be so close that you really have to scrap out and just try and get every single vote that you can.
Well, and Tony, Tim Walz, the VP nominee, was here on Tuesday before the debate. The second gentleman, Doug Emhoff, was in Tucson last night. Safe to say that we're going to be seeing more national Democrats in Arizona between now and Election Day?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's already, you know, rumors I'm hearing about things that are coming up. And they will continue to invest in our state, and there will be a big presence here.
Paul, I'm curious what you make of some of the things that former President Trump said yesterday, talking specifically about economic issues, housing issues, which are, of course, really big issues here.
Yeah, absolutely. Those are some of the top issues facing the state. And him being focused on issues would be helpful here. I don't know if Tucson was the best audience for that, but these audiences that we're talking about, it really speaks to Arizona being the ultimate battleground state. I do believe that the road to the White House comes through Arizona, and I think both campaigns are realizing that.
Hmm.
I think we're going to see a lot of visits to Arizona over the next 50-plus days because it's so important. And, you know, issue-wise, I think Trump did a little better in his speech than what he did in the debate. But that being said, he still talked about the Haitian immigrants and still brought up a lot of his quote-unquote greatest hits, the things that I think hold against him. But to Tony's point about the pop culture relevance, I don't know if SNL is live this week, but if it is, I suspect that we're going to see a nice big debate performance. And just like we saw with Sarah Palin, where they were able to sort of capture this image of Sarah Palin and perpetuate it sort of the national audience, I think we're going to see that sort of rehash of the debate, full of jokes and full of things that really sort of cast the president's performance in a very negative light. And I think that will have an impact.
It's interesting. I mean, we know that Maya Rudolph, for example, is coming back to play Kamala Harris. It's interesting, sort of the pop culture, because when Sarah Palin was running, the whole "I can see Russia from my house," a lot of people thought she said that, but in fact, it was Tina Fey as Sarah Palin saying that. So it's an interesting point about how pop culture can sort of seep into the campaign. Are you seeing evidence of that happening in this election, Tony?
I am, and I think that part of an interesting thing about this campaign versus when SNL made such a big impact on Sarah Palin is that there's way more people using social media. There's mm-hmm. way more viral video sites like TikTok. And so when some of these things hit, they hit and they go really, really far. And I do think that, that's why both the campaigns are actively using TikTok to try and talk to voters, not just younger voters. There's a lot of users on that site. You got to talk to voters where they are. And I do think that this type of pop culture stuff is going to make a difference.
Well, and Taylor Swift, for a great example, same night as the debate. I think that is very impactful. Having Linda Ronstadt come out and decry Trump performing at the Linda Ronstadt Center, Stevie Nicks, these artists, these female artists, in particular female artists that appeal to broad swaths. I mean, you see that they're going to have an effect talking to these female voters. Plus, we've got the abortion issue on the ballot here. I think there is a lot of convergence going on that's going to have people paying a lot of attention.
So I want to ask you guys briefly before you go to break. Secretary of State Adrian Fontes was in D.C. this week testifying before a committee. And one of the points he made was that, you know, look, we all want free, fair elections to run smoothly. But you guys, Congress, you got to fund this. You got to help us do what we need to do. Paul, is this something that you think the feds or really anyone is going to pay enough attention to?
I certainly think they should. I mean, the Center for the Future of Arizona is going to put out numbers about the confidence in the elections. And the majority of the electorate still believes that the elections are free and fair and conducted in a way that it gets the right results. But the challenge is we are seeing a degradation of that, particularly among Republicans. And the only way I think to continue to make sure, as Tony pointed out, if the former president doesn't win, he's going to cast even greater doubt on that. I think that investment is worth the time to make sure that we protect our elections.
I mean, it's kind of tough to get a lot of stuff through Congress these days. Any chance that some more cash comes Arizona's and other states' way, do you think?
I don't have a lot of confidence that they will. I know that there are some people that just want there to be not any federal oversight of our elections, especially when it comes to funding. And you know, that's one of the challenges, is that I just don't know if they'll be able to get the votes through unless there's some sort of a major issue. But these departments are wildly underfunded. They don't have the resources they need in order to do the things that we want. And, you know, this is the most important thing. We want as many people as possible to vote. It's better, period. You know, regardless of what political party it helps. And I think there's some debate in this election about if there is high turnout, who it helps, right? But the point is, it doesn't matter. In our democracy, we want as many people to participate as possible. It's the backbone of everything in our country, and we do need the federal government to be helping.
All right, that is Tony Khani. I'm also joined by Paul Bentz. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guests this week, Democratic strategist Tony Khani and Paul Bentz of High Ground. Paul, let me start with you on a ruling in the case of a legislative candidate in the Southeast Valley who had been challenged by another Republican over residency, over the fact that this candidate had voted in another state in some recent elections. The court said he was still eligible to run here.
Right. And they come down to they're saying it's something about a state of mind where you believe you live. And I think that's a challenging issue to address. Residency things are not new. We've seen it in state legislature for quite a while where legislators do not live where they say they live. You've got folks with a mattress on the floor in their house or clearly even stating on their mortgage documents that their primary residence is way outside the district. People renting apartments and not living in them. It's been a long-standing issue. We've had private investigators. You've had lots of people tracked. I mean, there was a big controversy. Someone put a tracker on a vehicle when they shouldn't have to track where people live. This has been an ongoing issue for a long time, and this just makes it murkier. I mean, this person voted in another place, and that's generally has been sort of the standard. In fact, I've talked to candidates who came back from serving in Washington, D.C., and one of the things we've always asked them is, did you vote in D.C. when you lived there?
Hmm.
And if they said yes, I said, then you ought not run because your residency was there that time. And they've come back and said, well, I was serving my country, and you know, but I've been an Arizona resident the whole time. Apparently, that would have flown. I had no idea. It's a bit of a surprise, especially in a heavily Republican district. I think that would have been a big upset had he been kicked off the ballot. But apparently, all it takes is you have to have a state of mind to live in a state for 6 years.
Have you guys had New York state of mind running through your heads this week, as I have? Maybe that's just me. Paul mentioned the idea that this is a very conservative district. I mean, Republicans are in all likelihood going to win this district. There had been some talk among some Democrats that if Michael Wei was ruled ineligible, maybe a Democrat could sneak in that could maybe tip the balance of power in the House. Is this in any way a blow to Democrats, do you think?
Well, it was an unexpected opportunity that did not materialize. So in that regard, all the planning for 2 years didn't include the fact that this would happen, that the Freedom Caucus would get mad at this one guy and then try and get him to, be kicked out. I think, looking at this, I do think that if somebody was running for statewide office and they talked about there being more accountability and transparency in the laws related to candidates, I think that that would be wildly popular because right now our campaign finance laws have absolutely no teeth. If you're in the legislature and you win office for the first time, you don't even have to post a report to say who you've raised money from your entire first year in office. So you'd be taking money from lobbyists. Voters have no idea. And then when people are, either violating this residency or violating campaign finance laws, it just nothing happens. And of course, it's because politicians are in charge of deciding what these penalties would be. And I think that as a result, they don't want there to be some of this accountability. But it is a problem that the laws that govern the way we do elections are just not being followed.
One thing that Tony brought up, though, I think is incredibly important for everyone to understand. The Freedom Caucus is the people that challenged this candidate, another Republican. They were willing, had he been kicked off the ballot, to risk losing control of a legislative body to make a point against one of their own so-called members.
And it shows, I think, just how governing is not an important thing to that chunk of the Republican Party that do, frankly, hold the largest influence when it comes to what's happening in the legislature right now.
Right, because they're a very vocal minority, but they are very powerful because they stand in the way of things. And it's more about loyalty than getting things done. And that's incredibly challenging. The idea that they would be willing to sacrifice control of a legislative body to make a point just seems counterintuitive for people who actually want to govern.
So, Paul, does that mean House Republican caucus meetings, must-see TV next session, assuming this candidate wins?
I certainly think it's going to be challenging. I think especially if the House is split 30-30, which there is a chance that that would happen.
Yeah.
It will definitely be must-see TV at that point.
Tony, Governor Hobbs last year issued some executive orders related to voting in terms of getting voter registration forms and allowing counties to use public buildings as polling places. The state Republican Party sued over this, saying that it exceeded her authority. The Supreme Court said, well, maybe you should have done this a little while ago. Was the end result on that any surprise to you?
No, I mean, I think that... Not really, because the Republican Party just sues all the time about elections in this state right now. Like, that's what they exist to do. They exist, it seems, to raise – I mean, the race to be the new chair, that was a big discussion. Like, we're going to do more of these lawsuits to do this and that. And, of course, it's just they keep falling up short. Frankly, we should be having more – I mean, this is – what she did was good. Like, we should be – we have all these government buildings. They're secure. They're protected. People go there for services already. That is a great place for you to be able to have a Dropbox or a polling place or these kinds of things. And so, yeah, I wasn't surprised that they lost, and I wasn't surprised that they wanted to make it harder for people to vote.
I'm not going to ask you to get inside the head of an attorney for the party, but if this was a concern, why not sue, let's say within 6 months of when the governor had issue this executive order as opposed to a few months before the election?
Because they want to make it a political issue. It's more about the politics of it and pointing this out and trying to pick a fight than it is to make a major policy goal here. I think ultimately it's ironic that, you know, Republicans often push for tort reform and things like that, but then are being much more litigious than anybody else in the state. But I think a lot of these things that we see is about making a point and trying to point something out. At the same time, the governor's folks, some of the folks I saw were really dunking on Republicans yesterday on social media of the outcome of the court case. I don't know if that's beneficial either. Certainly, the Republicans have done a lot of things with these lawsuits that have been, silly at best, and some of them are just very damaging. But it's speaking to their narrative about the election itself and trying to feed this idea that people are trying to take the election away or trying to put the thumb on the scale to change the way the election's conducted to benefit their candidates.
I want to ask you guys about one more lawsuit before we have to wrap up. And this is related to a pair of transgender girls in Arizona who sued over a state law banning transgender girls from playing girls sports in schools. And a judge has ruled against Tom Horn, who is trying to enforce that law. And I'm curious, Paul, specifically as it relates to sort of the quote unquote culture wars, as you know, we've been seeing over the last few years. And is this still an issue that you think is on voters' minds as they're heading to the polls this October and November? And might this case play any role whatsoever?
It is an issue on Republicans' minds. And I think sports is one of the ones that is interesting simply because the bathroom issue or some of the other ones that you see don't cut across a broader spectrum. But the sports one, when it comes to competition, look at the Olympics and the female boxer that they alleged that was not, and the sort of controversy that stirs up and the opinion that it creates about competition in the sense of sports, I think it creates a little bit more controversy there. I think it's something that Tom Horn knows feeds his base and gets him on the right side of things. I think ultimately it's going to be challenged all the way up. I don't think that this is the end of it. But for a certain segment, it's, again, another base-building exercise. We talked earlier about how Trump talks about things that build up his base, whether it's immigration, whether it's these issues in Ohio or wherever else. And this is another issue that sort of fits into that category.
Tony, do you think this is still an issue? Transgender rights, girls, transgender girls on girls sports teams, is this something voters are thinking about as they head to the polls?
I don't think this is a thing that is helping people win elections outside of Republican primaries. I think there's evidence all over the country to that effect. You know, it's interesting, like, you know, Paul mentioned the bathroom bill and all these other things. Like, essentially what this is that Americans support rights for LGBTQ Americans. You know, they do. And that is something that has been building in this country for a long time. And the people who oppose that have just tried a million different strategies to try and find a way to demonize a group of people for who they love. And they try this, they try that, they try this, they try and see what sticks. That's really what this is about. This isn't about people who suddenly are concerned about, girl sports or women's sports. Just ask them what they think about the WNBA if you think that this is about protecting people in women's sports. They will be very negative about it. And that's what this is. It's really disheartening. It impacts people's lives. They're using it as a political weapon that isn't going to even work, but it does have major consequences for people, who are facing, discrimination as a result of it.
All right, I have to leave it there. Tony, Connie, Paul Benz, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we dive into the world of Arabian horse breeding. But first, back in 2016, Pastor Caleb Campbell started to notice something. Campbell is the lead pastor at Desert Springs Bible Church in North Phoenix. And for as long as he'd been there, the congregation hadn't been that political. But that year, he started to notice pushback against some of the church's initiatives, like caring for refugees. People would come up to him after sermons and ask why he was pushing a, quote, liberal agenda. When Campbell preached against violent acts by police or called for humane treatment of immigrants, he would receive text messages and emails from congregants questioning whether those values were truly Christian. By 2021, the sentiments had reached what Campbell calls a fever pitch, and he wanted to figure out what was going on. Someone suggested he should check out an event at a nearby church billed as a revival. The event was hosted by Turning Point USA, and when Campbell walked in, he was stunned. The gathering had all the hallmarks of a worship service, praise songs and sermons, but with a notable twist. At the pulpit, the person leading the service was making the case that a true reading of Scripture compelled Christians to declare their total allegiance to right-wing political causes. Campbell realized he was witnessing a spiritual community overtaken by what he calls American Christian nationalism, a movement that conflates spiritual teachings with an overtly nationalist political agenda. It bore no resemblance to the version of faith that had called him to become a pastor, and he resolved to do something about it. The result is a new book called Disarming Leviathan, Campbell's attempt to diagnose and treat the root causes of American Christian nationalism. And as he told the show's Sam Dingman, his approach is informed in part by a fateful hike.
So I was hiking in northern Arizona and had come across the carcass of a deer that had been ensnared and entangled in some loose barbed wire. And it seemed to me like this creature was not only ensnared, but was feeling trapped and fought against it and eventually took its life. But I remember thinking, what would I do if I came across this deer and it was still alive? What would I do to try to help it? And some of the things as I've thought about this that have come to mind are, well, I first of all need to convince it that I'm not its enemy. And so doing everything I could to create a calming presence, to communicate, I'm for you, I want your good. And then second, I'd need the right tools. In this case, like wire cutters or something like that. Right. because if you don't have the right tools, you can't help people. And then third, I'd need to know how to use the tools. And I'd need to be really careful as I used them because I don't want to cause more injury.
Yes. And if I may, it seems like one of the reasons that you are so appreciative of these tools as you're describing them that are informed by this spirit of love and compassion and empathy for the person who you perceive to be in crisis is because you had that approach extended to you during a time in your life when you were affiliated with a white nationalist group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in the 90s, I was a fellow with a group of neo-Nazi skinheads and had given myself over to it. And one of the things that I think often gets misunderstood is it's common to think that the ideology comes first and then the community comes second. But in most people's experience, I think, it's actually the inverse. I wasn't sitting around reading a genetics book, reasoning myself into white supremacy. I was at a party. There was a bunch of tough-looking dudes that invited me to come over and hang out with them. You know, we exchanged phone numbers. They invite me to a party. And over time, I became one of them. And in order to belong and to continue my belonging in that community, you're incentivized to fall in with the ideology. And in this case, the promises of safety, belonging, and purpose were a deception. And the way that you could tell was if you asked the wrong questions, you would be kicked out of the community. And true safety and true community exist where you're able to ask whatever question you want without fear of expulsion.
Yeah. Well, and to illustrate this, one of the things that you write about in that section where you're talking about your transition away from this group of skinheads is you eventually find your way to a community of faith that you are interested in and that intrigues you, but that you have some questions about. And there's one member of this community in particular who starts like just inviting you over to talk and have beer, which you're sort of momentarily scandalized by.
Yeah. So I had started to play the drums at the church that I'm now the lead pastor of and was still very suspicious of Christians, thought they were all hypocrites. But I felt like I should do good stuff for God. That was kind of my idea at the time. And I liked playing the drums. And one of the band members started inviting me, he and his wife invited me over to their house about every week. And the invitation was, you know, after dinner, we'll grab a couple beers and talk about what makes you angry about religion. And at that season of my life, that was my dominant emotion, was rage. And so I had lots of stuff to talk about. And they were not agreeing with me all the time, although sometimes they did. But they were practicing hospitality and compassion, and they were honoring me just by listening. And over the course of a year in those meetings, I found myself following Jesus because I saw Jesus through them.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I'm really struck in the story that you just shared by something that I feel like I hear people say sometimes, but I don't know if I've ever heard illustrated quite as clearly as you just did, which is that you said you found Jesus in these folks.
Yeah.
In the form of an ethos, in the form of a spirit, to use somewhat religious language, rather than a guy named Jesus who believed certain things.
Yeah.
And that seems important to me because as I was reading the book, there did seem to be a little bit of a tension that I wanted to ask you about, which is that you're arguing against the ultimate allegiance to American Christian nationalism, but you're not against submission to the idea of Jesus and his teachings as you interpret them.
Yeah.
Why is that different for you? And should Jesus be open to criticism as well?
Ah, great question. So in my understanding of the nature of humanity, of which I am certainly not an expert, we are all centering something in the core of our being. It's the story that we believe that we're a part of. It could be ourself, it could be sex, it could be money, it could be power. And so the question is not, should I center something or not? We're all doing it. The question is, what belief or person will ultimately lead to human flourishing? And I have found the story of Jesus to be not only captivating, but also existentially satisfying. And so to your second question, is Jesus open to critique or criticism or questioning? In my reading of the Christian scriptures, it's a bunch of people asking questions about God, oftentimes criticizing him, which God seems to invite. In my relationship with my deepest friends, those relationships are always founded on really profound questions that we're asking each other. And I think it's the same with our relationship with God.
So, last question.
Sure.
Elsewhere in the book, you write, American Christian nationalism attempts to sink two incompatible ideologies, namely nationalism and the way of Jesus. One must consider how much nationalism can be mixed in with the gospel before it makes people spiritually sick. So, would you say the goal with this book is a defense of America from American Christian nationalism, or a defense of spiritual purity, Christian or otherwise?
My heart is primarily being real clear about the good news of Jesus. Because I think if we get real clear on that, then we can actually, Christians can actually help America grow in healthiness. So my primary goal is focused on the church. Now, this is as a pastor. However, I love my country and I want what's best for her. And so I hope both are outcomes of the book. But if I had to pick one, I'd first pick the church because I think a healthy church in America will bless America in the long run.
Okay. Well, Caleb Campbell is the author of Disarming Leviathan and the lead pastor at Desert Springs Church here in Phoenix. Caleb, thank you so much for this conversation.
Sam, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. A former employee of the Phoenix Suns is claiming she was discriminated against and wrongly terminated. She's filed a complaint against the team and could ultimately sue. Baxter Holmes, a senior writer with ESPN, has been following the Suns' workplace for several years and has written about this latest turn. He's with me to talk more about it. And Baxter, who is the former employee who's filed this complaint?
Yeah, so this is Andrea Trishon. She was the Suns' program manager of diversity, equity, and inclusion. She joined the team, well, her hire date was in late September of 2022, and her hire date was just a little bit after. But this was a key time because she joined right after then-owner Robert Sarver was suspended 1 year and fined $10 million following an NBA investigation into his conduct and into the team's workplace culture during his 18-year tenure as the team's majority owner.
And her job, it seems, at least in part, was to try to clean some of that up.
Yeah. So with respect to the issue, that the subject of diversity, I would say that was one of the things that the NBA addressed in its investigation. In my reporting, in my story from November of 2021, That was a subject that a lot of current and former employees brought up as well. And so, yes, there was an effort by the organization, an ongoing effort to try to address that issue. And she was certainly part of it.
So what happened? I mean, it seems as though it didn't really go that well for her.
No, it didn't. She ultimately ended up being there only about 10 months. And if I would focus on a couple of key points, you know, so she joins the organization in November of 2022. She's been there about a couple months. She says that the team notified her that they were creating a diversity council that was going to be comprised largely of executives for the team. Well, about 1 month later, I published a long investigative story detailing allegations of misconduct against several Suns executives who were holdovers from the Sarver era and that employees alleged had played key roles in driving and perpetuating aspects of their workplace culture. And she looked at the story and the names that I mentioned and recognized that several were listed on the diversity council, one of her areas of focus. And she immediately saw that as being problematic and described wanting to investigate some of these claims. And then she says that she was told by Kim Corbett, who is the head of HR for the Suns and was her direct report, that she needed to cease her investigation. And from then on, really, she described being both retaliated against, discriminated against. She was later put on a performance improvement plan and terminated by the organization in the summer of 2023.
And presumably those things are the basis for this lawsuit?
Yeah. Now, I should be clear here. She hasn't filed a formal lawsuit. And I should add potentially just yet.
Okay.
Now, at the point, what she has done is soon after she was terminated, she filed formal civil rights complaints with the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Arizona Attorney General Office's Civil Rights Division. So she filed complaints with both of those. They're, you know, one's a federal entity, one's a state entity. They can decide kind of who picks it up. The Civil Rights Division and the Arizona AG's office picked it up. And she has been seeking, and at times the Suns have been seeking mediation, but I would say, you know, kind of a settlement to the dispute. But what I could say is that her attorney and the document that I obtained, they made quite clear that they have a formal complaint, you know, meaning a lawsuit ready to file, and that they anticipate doing so. The deadline would be November 13th. Now, that would be 1 year to the day after she filed her formal complaint with the Civil Rights Division of the Arizona Attorney General's Office, and I expect them to do so.
Is she seeking monetary damages mostly?
Yes. So $60 million is the amount that she is seeking from the Suns. That's a not nothing figure for an employee. And I should note here, look, the Suns have denied her claims. They've denied her allegations. They've described them as a baseless charge. And, these claims are egregious and a ridiculous demand for $60 million. You know, they believe that the courts will find no merit to these claims and quickly resolve this matter. So it's certainly, but if he said, she said right now, but yes, $60 million is the ask on her end.
Okay. And just in terms of sort of the timeline here, I mean, you mentioned that she was brought in around the time that former owner Robert Sarver announced he was going to sell the team. And there's been a lot of effort, as I'm sure you know, to try to, you know, clean things up there with Matt Ishbia coming in and, you know, make the organization better overall, especially sort of the behind the scenes staff, you know, staff wise. How does this fit into everything that the new ownership group is trying to do?
Yeah, look, there have certainly been efforts by the new leadership team. And I should principally focus on Matt Ishbia here, to move the organization forward, to repair issues that remain from the Sarver era. One topic that I would mention, and she focused on it in her complaint, and it was something that I, in my initial December 2022 investigative report, focused on as well. And I should also add that the NBA's investigative report touched on this quite a bit. There are still executives there that are holdovers from the Robert Sarver era in key leadership positions across the organization, whom employees allege then and now, both in my reporting and in the NBA's report, were key individuals who perpetuated aspects of a problematic workplace culture. And so while the organization has sought to move forward, as you rightly point out, there are still some people there that I would say employees have at times had very mixed feelings about in terms of the ability to move forward. Like, how can we move forward if some of these folks are still helping run this place? I'm very interested to see where this leads. And I say that because in my initial reporting, a lot of employees were asked, you know, like, oh, you dealt with, you know, like you claim discrimination or retaliation or harassment or wrongful termination. You know, why didn't you ever file a lawsuit? And so many people that I talked to over the last 4 years described that at different points during their tenure with the Sun, like they really thought about it. But they felt like they didn't have the financial resources to do so. Maybe they hadn't really chronicled the evidence they would need that would hold up in a court of law. And so there's not a long paper trail, quite honestly, of employees kind of going after the Suns for things that they alleged to have happened during their time there. And so the thing that I would end with is that if in fact, let's say in the coming weeks, a lawsuit is filed by a former Suns employee who alleges misconduct within the Suns and mistreatment and so on and so forth, it would be something that a lot of people have told me that they wish they would have done. So it would be a key step in the overall arc of the story of the Suns' workplace culture for a lot of employees who feel that they probably had grounds to do the same, but for whatever reason, just couldn't get there.
Interesting. All right. That is Baxter Holmes, senior writer with ESPN. Baxter, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The Arabian National Breeder Finals is happening now in Scottsdale. It features competition horses from all over the world, Brazil, Belgium, Europe, the Middle East, and across the country. But Scottsdale is a mecca for the sport. You've probably heard of the bigger Arabian Horse Show that happens there every spring. The Breeders' Finals features horses shown in hand and ridden, celebrating the centuries-old breed. Well, our next guest this morning has spent his entire life in the world of Arabian horses, though he did try a more traditional career path before beginning to buy and breed his own horses a decade ago. Now, Austin Garrett is managing partner at MNS Farms in Cave Creek, and today he'll be showing six different horses at the Breeders' Finals. His chestnut filly Aloara AG won the Scottsdale Signature Stallion Auction Championship earlier this year. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke with him more about the world of Arabian horse breeding and what the competition looks like.
Arabian National Breeders' Finals, I tend to call it just the Breeders' Finals, is going strong, and it's going to include horses that are shown both in hand and being ridden. And I like to compare the in-hand horses to like showing dogs, if you've ever watched Westminster on TV.
Right, okay.
It's a lot like that, just with a much larger dog.
So you mentioned dog shows, which is kind of what I would think of initially when I thought of what this might look like, right? But you said there's also people riding horses. Is that more like dressage, like what we saw at the Olympics at Versailles?
Not so much dressage. While Arabian horses do compete in dressage events, none of that's going to be featured here. So we have what are called performance classes, which tend to harken back to olden times, the way that you might have seen something ridden. So if you think about like the Wild West, we've got horses that are ridden by folks dressed up like cowboys and in the hat cool, and the chaps and everything like that. All the way to, if you go back to like the English aristocracy, what we call saddle seat horses that are ridden with a coat and tails that are big, high stepping, high energy kind of horses, as well as horses that tend to harken back to fox hunting.
So there's all different styles of this. Okay. So
there
one,
is, yeah.
Yeah. One question I have when I've read about these shows and when you have the bigger Arabian horse show, like you said, in February, is why Arabian horses? Like, I think we kind of might understand what a horse show looks like or, you know, what a horse competition was, but why Arabians?
Yeah. For me, I can tell you personally, Arabians are incredibly smart. They are incredibly loyal, kind. I have never seen a horse interacts with a person the way they do. And their beauty and the way that they present themselves is unique. And it just, it can really blow your mind. I, you know, personally find myself in those special situations where I get goosebumps. And that is such a strong feeling for me, and something that has brought me into the space and certainly kept me there.
So let's talk about your role as the breeder and handler, right? Do you ride the horses?
I do, but not very well. And so you won't see me in competition.
Okay. And you got into this sort of after, you know, a regular career, it sounds like working as a program manager at Amazon, right? Like, how did you make this your full-time job?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've had a fulfilling professional career, and I've been able to transition into breeding and showing a ton of horses, which has just been a huge passion of mine for a long time. I come from a family that's been involved in Arabian horses for four generations. Mm. And so I was kind of born into it, but took a chance to go and have a quote unquote real job before I started and spending a lot of time in this space.
That's so interesting. So talk about your family a little bit. How were you involved in this as a kid? Like, what are your memories of it?
My great-grandparents on my dad's side and my grandparents on my mom's side were both heavily involved back in the 60s and 70s when some of this stuff was just getting started. And as I was growing up, you know, I was in those households. I'd go and see grandma and grandpa and go down to spend some time with their horses. And then both of my parents were professional horse trainers, and they lived and breed the horse. And so I was able to kind of grow up in that space. It was something that when I was a kid, I kind of felt like it was a chore. It wasn't necessarily something that I was in love with or passionate about. But when I was 12 or 13, I came to really fall in love with it and understand where that came from. And I started showing horses when I was about 14 years old. And now I've been fortunate enough to be doing that for quite a long time.
So talk about the breeding process. I mean, like, how do you make sure that you get the best horse out of it? We talk about dog breeding a little bit, but like, what does it look like when it comes to Arabian horses?
You know, Arabian horses are one of the oldest, if not the oldest, set of bloodlines that have been continuously recorded. It goes all the way back, hence the name, back to the Arabian Peninsula, mm-hmm. Out in the desert, where you would have these war bands of Bedouin folks that were literally living with these horses. We were able to record these horses all the way back to that point. So with that much knowledge and that much in our back pocket of being able to know and see, we've been able to understand kind of what certain combinations of bloodlines will do, what we're going to potentially get out of something. Of course, you're rolling the dice no matter what. Mm-hmm. You never necessarily know what's going to happen. Nature is going to do its own thing. But you do your best to identify a horse that's going to be good at what you're looking for it to do, whether that's continuing to be a breeding animal and showing in hand, or potentially something that's more specialized to be ridden in our performance classes. There are a lot of specific bloodlines that lend themselves to showing in our saddle seat classes or showing in our Western classes.
That's fascinating. It's like a glimpse into this entire world I don't know anything about. I love that. So I want to know, lastly, what you love about this. Like, you have this, you know, award-winning championship horse, Alora AG, right? Like, what do you love about that horse?
Yeah. For me, it's a passion that brings excitement. There is so much that's happening out there in the arena in real time. It's incredibly fun to watch, and it's incredibly fun to be a part of. When I'm out there with a horse like mine, it almost feels like a dance. To be out there, to get a chance to work together, and I've built this bond with the horse that has been incredibly fulfilling for me. And that's what I've found continues to be the foundation, not only for me, but many other people who are involved with these horses. They're incredibly smart, and I don't know if we give them enough credit for how smart they are, how much they can feel what you're feeling. It's almost like working with an empath every day who can really feel exactly how you're feeling. And your energies can certainly be shared between each other, and it's a really special connection that's created there.
Yeah. All right. Well, good luck this weekend. That is Austin Garrett, managing partner at M&S Farms, Arabian horse breeder. Austin, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for telling us about this. It's fascinating.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you for your time.
And that'll do it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. The show is produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, Ayanna Hamilton, and reporter Sam Dingman, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, our news director. The show was created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.